couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Arthur the King, One Life, a look back at 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and Two Evil Eyes. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Elon Musk is a Total Idiot, it's at twitter.com/Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First of all, the box office did extremely well for Kung Fu Panda 4. There are some people who are thinking, well, you know, maybe it's not going to beat Dune 2 on its second weekend. Because Dune, I mean, it was like in the 80s in that first release. Dune 2 had a pretty good hold. It held at 44%, which is really good for, especially for a big movie like that. But Kung Fu Panda 2, $58 million. That's a huge amount. I think that's more than some of the other sequels of the Kung Fu Panda franchise. And this one was kind of done on the cheap in a lot of ways. Dune Part 2, like I said, it's doing quite well. It looks like it's going to have some staying power. It looks like it might play closer to Oppenheimer than a Marvel sci-fi movie that tends to drop pretty quickly. Imaginary came in third with just under $10 million, which is okay, basically for the budgets. That's what they do when they have those kind of movies. Cabrini came in at 7.1, which is not bad. It was an Angel Studios release, and that's the people who did The Sound of Freedom. And then Bob Marley, One Love, came in on fifth. But let's talk about some other news. Let's talk about Scream 7. Scream 7 is back on the table. And if you recall, there was this big hiccup because they did the Scream reboot and then they did a sequel. And they kind of had this powerhouse twofer with Melissa Barada and Jenna Ortega as the two leads in this series. And that was the young blood that was going to help. And one of the things that happened in the last Scream movie is they're saying, okay, let's finish off the stories with the legacy characters. We're going to finish off Courtney Cox and David Arquette and Neve Campbell, and even Hayden Panettiere was in there. And they said, okay, let's give them their exit, and now we're going to focus on the younger generation. Well, that all got blowed up when Melissa Barada made some comments. And look, I'm not here to judge. It's just she made these comments, and I think it was probably a little reactionary for somebody to fire her. So she got fired over what she said. And Jenna Ortega, unrelated, wasn't going to come back because she's so busy doing other things because Wednesday made her such a huge star, and she's got to do second season of that and everything. So suddenly they were left without any of the new characters. And I think they finally went back and they got Neve Campbell. They said, look, okay, I know you said you weren't going to do it again, and it was because of a salary dispute. Well, now there's plenty of money to pay you what you asked for because Melissa Barada and Jenna Ortega are not going to be involved in it. I don't know if that's what happened behind closed doors, but I guarantee you Neve Campbell got what she was asking for in this kind of a negotiation. Also, Kevin Williamson is coming back. I think he's directing this one, which it could be good or bad because, you know, Kevin Williamson is classic Scream, 90s horror, you know, stuff like I Know What You Did Last Summer. He was involved in all that kind of stuff. So if you can't get Wes Craven to come back and direct it because he passed away several years ago, they're deciding to get Kevin Williamson. So this is a big news, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think some of the fans are still jilted by the studio's treatment of Melissa Barrera and the reactionary firing her for her. I never saw anything that I thought was, you know, really beyond the pale. But, you know, we'll see. Nobody wants to admit they're wrong after something like this, and I'd be surprised if she would even come back if they asked her. The next piece of news I want to just quickly hit is, you know, send out support. Olivia Munn, most people recognize her from, well, she got her start in Attack of the Show on G4, and, you know, so sort of like that geek nerd culture, and it was all like teenagers who would watch it, so they loved her because she's beautiful, and she was game to kind of goof around, and she wasn't offended when they were, like, you know, making obviously sexual jokes about her because She was an attractive woman hosting a geek show. But apparently she had last year gotten cancer. She had an aggressive form of breast cancer that they discovered after she had a routine mammogram. The numbers weren't quite there, and so they did this risk assessment and did an MRI and discovered she had this in both breasts, and she ended up having a double mastectomy sometime last year, and she finally came out and announced all this. And it's actually quite touching. If you go to her Instagram page, she talks about it, and she has pictures of her treatment and a little video right before she's having a surgery where she's talking to her OBGYN, and she talks about, you know, the risk factors and stuff, because she's like 43. And, you know, once you start getting over 30, the risk factors go up for women with breast cancer. So, and men, too. Men are absolutely susceptible to breast cancer. So these are things that if anything, I think she wants to show through her situation that people should get tested and keep track of that, because early detection can sometimes save your life. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer is for The First Omen, which comes to theaters in just a couple weeks on April 5th.
There's this girl at the orphanage. I think that she really needs someone to look out for her.
Carlita
suffers from a touch of madness.
What does any of this have to do with Carlita?
This church has maintained power for thousands of years. It will stop at nothing to keep it that way. I believe the girl is to be the mother.
Mother of what?
At first, I was a little skeptical of this because, you know, just make a new story. You're building off of a movie that's almost 50 years old, or it's close to 50. Was it 76 was when The Omen came out? So, yeah, it's just like, yeah, get a new movie, you know, do another demonic movie. But apparently this is the story of the woman that is to give birth to the Antichrist, and then they slip it into Gregory Peck's life. This looks interesting, but I've seen way too many of these completely fall apart when they get there. So the trailer looks cool, but we'll see. The next one I want to hit is The Crow, which comes to theaters on June 7th.
Julie!
When someone dies,
a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead.
But sometimes something so bad happens
that the soul cannot rest until you put the wrong things right.
I'm gonna kill them. Every single one of them.
I like The Crow. I think it's a very good movie. I remember seeing it back in the 90s. It made me more of a fan of the director, Alex Proyas, than necessarily the movie. I thought Brandon Lee, even though he was appropriate for the role, his presence was good, his acting wasn't great. And I think it became a bigger movie because of him getting killed on set. So now they're remaking it 30 years later. You've got Bill Skarsgård in it. And look, I think he's great. I thought he was wonderful in it. I mean, I think he's got a lot of potential, not just as a sort of a weird actor, but as just a dramatic actor. And I am all for a supernatural John Wick, which is what this seems to be setting up to be. But you know, look, here's the thing. This looks like it's perfectly shot, so you don't see a doggone thing in this movie. This looks like it's going to have all that underexposed cinematography. It's going to have that naturalistic lighting. And as cool as the movie might end up being, it's going to look like garbage because the trailer looks like garbage. On top of that, this is like the meth addict version of The Crow. And part of the thing is the original movie, and it's been a while since I've seen it, the original movie, they were just two somewhat damaged people who fell in love. But at a certain point, you say, do they have to be this damaged? So I don't know. We'll see. It could be decent, but I don't know. I'm not feeling it right now. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the Oscar recap and One Life.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to push back the reviews here for a minute and talk about the Oscars because they were last weekend. I kind of want to sound off. My predictions were almost exactly right. I missed Best Actress. Lily Gladstone is who I chose because she was the favorite going in. Emma Stone ended up winning. But even then, I said that's probably the closest of those. But, you know, Oppenheimer winning Best Picture, Director, Actor, and Supporting Actor. And then Devine Joy Randolph winning Best Supporting Actress. Everybody was picking that. That was clear. And can I just say that Randolph just killed it with her speech? She was so heartfelt and passionate. I mean, her Oscar speech is the kind of Oscar speech that people remembered. She never thought she'd be on that stage. I don't think she ever thought she was going to be in major movies anyways, because it sounds like she was a big bundle of insecurities and stuff. And then she got there and she was, there was nobody more grateful to be there than this woman. So I thought it was really sweet to watch her win. But ultimately, overall, I mean, it was not a big surprise that Oppenheimer won. I'm glad that it didn't, like, sweep. I'm glad it didn't get, like, 11 or 12 wins and break any records, because then you would never hear the end of it. But, I mean, it picked up, like, what, 5 or 6? I mean, it did well for it. So 7, I think it was 7 was the number. And as much as Christopher Nolan does annoy me, and as much as I do think he's a pretentious windbag, I thought his speech was rather nice. I thought he was very gracious in his speech. And it was nice to see him, at a certain point, try to not make it about himself, which is great, because everything else I've ever seen Christopher Nolan talk about, it's always like, look how brilliant I am in the movie I'm making. But there's, like, I was surprised that Poor Things won all those sort of artistic awards, you know, costume design and production design, because I really thought Barbie had a shot at those. But it seemed that the Academy had a lot more love for Poor Things. And I think that shows something in terms of an evolution of the Academy, because they've talked for years about how the Academy was kind of old and stuffy. And Poor Things is not an old and stuffy person's movie. And I think the love that the Academy showed for Things, and it tipped the scales on the close races, in particular with Barbie and Lily Gladstone, those wins showed that I think there's a diversification and an attempt to make the Academy voter younger and more in touch with Things. So I think that's a good sign. Another thing was Jimmy Kimmel. Took him 4 times, but finally he became the safe host. So I think that he's going to be the go-to guy, because he's like, well, he's not doing anything controversial. He's not causing any problems. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, he did a dig at Trump. But hey, you know what? Let's be fair. Trump made a dig first. Trump's the one who's tweeting about it and attacking him. Why not? You're an idiot if you're going to sit there and attack somebody on live TV. They get a chance to take a shot at you. Now, John Cena, I thought was great. I love that John Cena he has enough of a sense of humor he can do that kind of thing. But if they had any real courage, they would have Jack Black do that. That would have shown some real stones on the Academy. And then the final thing, I know Jonathan Glazer is getting a lot of blowback for his speech. And I'm not going to weigh in either way on this one, because I'm not going to step in the political bear trap that it is. But I know people have always said, how dare he use that time to say something political. And I've always said this. Look, if you're a presenter, stick to the script. If you're the MC, stick to the script. But if you win an award and you're given time, that's your time. You can talk whatever you want. If you had a beef with a construction contractor, fine. Use your Oscar speech to complain about your construction. That is your time. You have earned it. You can talk about whatever you want. And to be fair, what Jonathan Glazer said, I don't think it was that incendiary. I think it ruffled a lot of feathers, but he's trying to make a point, and he's trying to make a point for, I guess, less death is what he's going for, less death and suffering. So that was his time. He gets to say what he wants. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about One Life. This is a smaller film. It's probably under a lot of people's radar, but I believe it's opening nationwide. It's a historical drama based on a true story. Anthony Hopkins plays a man who reflects on his efforts to save hundreds of children from the Nazis in the buildup to World War II.
An extraordinary story about a young man who many years ago visited Prague. What he found there were thousands of refugees at the mercy of Hitler's imminent invasion.
Do you ever think about the children and what happened to them?
We are working to evacuate these children.
Nikki, you must know we cannot save them all.
I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know about this guy. There's so much that happened during the buildup of World War II in so many different countries with so many different people and so many different perspectives that a lot of these are stories that a lot of people don't know. And the other thing that's interesting about this one, it's a European story. It all takes place in Europe, in Czechoslovakia and in Britain. So there's no like American presence to it. And let's face it, every country, not just Americans, but any country you live in, you're going to be ethnocentric. You're going to be thinking about your country first in your reflection, because that's how you view the world. You know, Americans view the world from America to the rest of the world. Britons view the world from Britain to the rest of the world, et cetera, et cetera. I understand why they filmed it the way they did, because you got Anthony Hopkins in it. You know, that's what's going to make this movie a big deal. But it's really not his story. It's his younger self's story. And it's harrowing, and it's frustrating, because you're looking at this thing. The whole point is he travels to Czechoslovakia and he finds all these refugees, and he's like, they're like, there's nothing happening bad to him yet, but they know if Hitler continues his march through Europe and ends up either annexing Czechoslovakia or just straight up invading, they know that all these children, a lot of them from Jewish descent, are going to end up dead. They're going to just disappear, and they don't know what's going to happen to them. So he's trying as best he can through the process, you know, saving hundreds of people, but there's thousands you couldn't save. And that's the real gut punch of a movie like this, because the reality is he did a lot of good, but the reflection of it from later in life is there's so many more he could have saved. And that's the heartbreaking part of this movie, but it's also very uplifting. Because it's not, he didn't just come in and save one kid or one family. Hundreds. I mean, like 600 and some. It's an alarming number that he saved. And an alarming number of those that didn't make it. So it's told in retrospect, because there's a lot of regret in the whole thing. And it's him, I think, takes place in the 70s or 80s. And he basically has to kind of get rid of his records, because they don't need him anymore. I mean, it's, you know, decades after the war, and it's told in flashback. And Hopkins is quite good. It's a very understated performance, which is kind of what he's doing now. He's not doing the over-the-top stuff. He's doing the understated things. But it's always worth making a movie like this, because it shows what the real people can do, and that help is needed everywhere. This kind of stuff's happening all... It's happening today. This is a tale that needs to be told about the strength and risks that everyday heroes make. I mean, he doesn't have cape. He's not a superhero. He's not a politician who can affect policy. He's just a guy trying to save lives. It's a tearjerker, but it's good. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Arthur the King and Two Evil Eyes. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about one of the other new ones this week, and that is Arthur the King. During a 400-mile race across the Dominican Republic, a group encounters a stray dog that becomes part of their team.
What happened to you, boy?
You don't look so good.
Uh-huh. Meatball? Look, somebody likes my meatballs.
Hey, Paw Patrol, we got a race to win.
This is my last chance to win.
3, 2, 1.
That's the dog I gave the meatballs to. 3 days, 200 miles ago.
Leave the stupid dog and let's go.
What is it, boy?
Oh,
God. Can't believe I almost walked right off that cliff.
Extra meatballs for you, my friend.
Team Broad Rail has traveled over 200 miles, and they found a companion.
Daddy has a dog?
These movies tend to be difficult, these sort of uplifting, inspirational movies, because they can get corny fast. And the other thing is, with inspirational movies, some of the writing and dialogue can just not work. I mean, because they're trying to make everybody a good person and a good character, and everybody does have flaws. So there's a challenge with these. And so that's the hardest struggle this movie has, because it starts off with Mark Wahlberg trying to put together this team, and he's overcoming the problems he has, his age, and you know, it's probably the last time he can do this, and he's got these estranged members of his racing team that he's got to kind of lure back into and excite them again about doing this. And then there's all the stuff with you know, him building the team and getting money and the sponsorships, and it at the first half of the movie is really more of a sports movie, and I'm not interested. I mean, look, it's one thing you can do a movie that's a sports movie that's like football, basketball, baseball, the very common sports that people can get behind. But if you did an inspirational sports movie about curling, that's a tough sell. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's a tough sell. And that's the thing with this movie, is it's a multidisciplinary sport. So it's not something you can really relate to. I mean, everybody at some point in their life has played a version of a football, basketball, or baseball game, you know, whether it was softball with the kids in school or just a pickup game and of basketball, you know, everybody's at least had access to that most of the time. I don't know what it's like to do biking and kayaking and mountain climbing and all this kind of stuff that they do. So there is a relatability factor that's not there. So it's the first half's a little bit rough, because all the characters have two legs. But I'll tell you, if you're going to make a movie a little boring and tough to sit through, do it in the first half. Cause once the dog shows up, I mean, the dog shows up a couple times, but it's like 45 minutes into the film, almost halfway through, that you finally get the dog to interact to a large extent with the other characters. And that's when things take off. Look, I am an easy mark for a dog movie. I love dogs. I'm a big dog fan. Who doesn't love dogs? I mean, there's some people that do, but they're horrible. But no, I mean, I love dogs. I'm a big dog person. And even a cheesy dog movie, the dog stuff still gets me, you know, like, you know, stuff like A Dog's Purpose and A Dog's Journey, all those, when the human characters I didn't care about, but I really got into the dog. And that's the point in here. I really like the dog, and the dog's the heart and soul of this movie. And it takes to about halfway through, but then when it hits it, it really hits a stride, and you really start having some fun with the dog, and it becomes very real. And I know it's based on a true story. There's some changes they make. Like, I think the original guy, it was Swedish, and they made it an American guy, I think, because obviously it was being funded by an American company, and they wanted to, you know, you make a lot of money with movies in America. But it's a wonderful little story. And, you know, it pushes all the buttons. You know, it has all the things you've seen a billion times before in a dozen other dog movies. But doggone it, no pun intended, if it doesn't work, it does. I mean, the human angle is disposable. But when the dog shows up, it's a wonderfully uplifting film. It really is sweet. It's worth seeing with a family. It's got a PG-13 rating, and most of that's for language. But yeah, no, it's good. I'm going to have to say, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about another film. And this one, I got to explain why I'm doing this one. Let's just play the trailer first. And it's for Two Evil Eyes. You can find it on Prime Video right now. It's from 1990. George A. Romero and Dario Argento adapt the Edgar Allan Poe stories, The Facts and the Case of M. Valamar and the Black Cat.
Wake me.
He's still alive.
From the creators of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead.
We are felons, Jessica. We have committed grand larceny here and fraud and God knows what else.
I am dead.
You killed her.
And I didn't kill her!
Just take one look at him, then tell me you think he's still alive.
I'm a huge fan of anthology movies. One of my favorites ever of all time is Creepshow, which George A. Romero directed. That was all Stephen King stories. I also like Edgar Allan Poe stories. They've had some rough adaptations, partly because some of the Poe stories are like one room, like Telltale Heart takes place. I mean, it's sort of in flashback, but the thrust of it is like just one scene. Very similar to the Black Cat. There's some things you see showing up in a lot of his stuff. The Black Cat and the Cask of Amontillado involved closing somebody up behind a wall and stuff like that. That the Black Cat and the Telltale Heart, they share some connective tissue in sort of what's going on. But there's so much imposed stuff that's internal, that's an internal monologue, makes it difficult to adapt. But the reason I swerved back into this movie is, if you recall, last week I talked about a giant blind spot in my horror movie watching, and that was Maniac Cop. And the reason I wanted to talk about that is because it has Tom Atkins in it, and I love Tom Atkins. Well, guess what Tom Atkins is also in? He's in Two Evil Eyes. Guess what he plays? He plays a cop with a mustache and a trench coat. That is Tom Atkins' go-to character. So I said, you know, I haven't seen this movie in years, so I figured I'd watch it. I saw it once in an all-night marathon and then again on, like, HBO in the early 90s. And Romero and Argento, they have history together because the two of them worked on Dawn of the Dead. Everybody knows Romero did Dawn of the Dead, but Argento worked on that especially for the international releases, and he was heavily involved in the film, and he's part of the reason why there's, like, 15 different cuts of the movie because he released them in different countries. But the two of them are classic horror movie directors, but they're very, very different. And it is no surprise that when you watch this movie, there's a jarring style difference between the first story, which is the facts in the case of Monsieur Valdemar, and The Black Cat. Romero does the Valdemar story, and Argento does The Black Cat. And Romero makes it feel very much like another episode from Creepshow. I mean, it's made like almost a decade later. So the filmmaking styles are a little bit different, but it really feels like the stuff that he did for Creepshow. It feels very familiar, and I really enjoyed it. That one has Adrienne Barbeau, and I love Adrienne Barbeau. She's a classic scream queen who I've always had. You know, what person who likes women and horror movies has not had a thing for Adrienne Barbeau? But when you get to the Dario Argento story, which is The Black Cat, and they're both about the same length. It's a two-hour movie. They're each one's about an hour long. It's just a jarring stylistic difference. It has Harvey Keitel stars in that, which is kind of surprising because I would have expected that to have been beneath him, not by my standards, but by his standards. But it's an interesting entry in his filmography because he's not known for this kind of stuff. But it's very grisly. It's very graphic. It's violent and gory. And they play a lot more with the background. I mean, the Black Cat story is very simple. It has these two or three beats that are the same. And then whenever they adapt it, they always change up who's getting revenge on whom. But it's an effective piece. It's just, there's the lack of warm and fuzziness that George Romero gives that lures you in. That's one of the things you got to be a little bit warm and fuzzy with your horror because it's got to lure you in so it can terrify you. When someone like what Dario Argento does, when you're coming from that Italian giallo filmmaking perspective, it can be off-putting and it doesn't suck you in unless you're a huge giallo fan or something like that. So, I mean, this is a grisly and graphic anthology horror that cuts itself off because there's too few stories in the collection. I mean, really, the whole point is I wanted to see three or four or five stories and you only get two. And at that point, you're just like, well, you just made 2-hour-long films. So, still, overall, it's enjoyable to watch. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews and talk about another classic. Probably more of a classic to most people than Two Evil Eyes, let's be honest there. And this is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Walt Disney adapts this classic Jules Verne story of a maverick submarine commander trying to protect the ocean.
The motion picture screen explodes with unprecedented power as the two masters of imagination, Jules Verne and Walt Disney, join to bring you a shattering new experience in entertainment.
The real story of the ocean depths begins where you left off. Wonders that defy my powers of description. The secrets that are mine alone.
Now, this is interesting where I ended up swerving into this movie, because recently, a couple weeks ago, I talked about The Black Hole, which is a great Disney movie. It's something that would have only been made at the time it was made. It has the vista and the scope of something like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, but it also has that sort of effects-driven movie that you eventually got with stuff like Tron, and ended up pittering away in Walt Disney Pictures into the 80s. But it always reminds me of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And there's a lot of connective tissue there, because the character that Maximilian Schell plays, Hans Reinhardt, I think is his name, in The Black Hole, he's very much like Captain Nemo. He's this sort of insane leader who is broken off from society and is living on his own in a very strange environment, you know, in the black hole or on a spaceship, and he's got a bunch of zombies. And on 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, his crew are people who he had released from slavery. I've never read Jules Verne's original story, but as I understand, it was kind of a serialized format. And that really, really worked for what Verne was writing in France at the time. Now, the thing when you adapt some of these older books, the structure of story is very different in the 20th century than it was, you know, the 19th and the 18th and 17th and sometimes even earlier. So it makes it difficult to adapt to a film, because, you know, film didn't exist then. So they couldn't do an adaptation like that for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea when it was actually taking place. And it was one, but it was one of those 1950s big studio adaptations. Also reminds me a lot of Forbidden Planet, where, you know, they find somebody who lives in this extreme environment, but there's a mystery there, but people, you have regular people sort of interacting with them. Now, when you watch this, it's visionary for the 50s. I think it was 1954 that it came out. And it's beautifully shot and beautifully done, but the story is lacking. That's the big thing. It's got a great cast, you know, like even Peter Lorre's in there as sort of a henchman. Kirk Douglas is sort of like the younger draw. James Mason plays Captain Nemo. And that's the thing. Sometimes it's Nemo's movie, sometimes it's Kirk Douglas's movie, whereas Kirk Douglas is who we relate to the most, because he finds it completely absurd that they're, you know, doing some of the things that they're doing. But it doesn't have a very strong story, because eventually it's sort of like the Nutcracker. I described it to my wife. I was talking about the movie. If you watch the Nutcracker, either the ballet or if you see a movie of it, the first half is the story, and then the second half is them just kind of running around the world going to different dances. And that's kind of what 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is. It's the setup, and they find the Nautilus, the submarine, and then the next half of the movie is them traveling the 20,000 leagues, because league is a distance, not a depth. So it's not 20,000 leagues below the sea, it's 20,000 leagues traveling while under the sea is what that means. And that's the story. And the book, as I understand it, is a series of adventures that they have and a series of things that they encounter, like the giant squid, and they have to fight the giant squid, which is cool and especially impressive for 1950s technology. Not so much now, but you got to watch everything as a piece of its time. So I really respect this movie. I do. I mean, it's visionary for the 50s, but it does suffer a bit from the serialized nature of the source material. I mean, it's hard to explain what the plot is of this because it doesn't have that normal narrative through line. But still, I'm going to have to say 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is pretty cool. It kind of rocks. Check it out. It's on Disney Plus. You can find it. It's about 2 hours long. It's worth checking out.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. This is actually available on Max as well, but it hit physical media this week. And it's available on DVD, Blu-ray, 4K.
I'm gonna kill Aquaman and destroy everything he holds dear. I'm gonna murder his family and burn his kingdom to ash.
He must be stopped, or a global meltdown is imminent.
I cannot believe you let this happen.
Yeah, well, I hate this job.
True king builds bridges, right?
really enjoyed the first Aquaman. I was very impressed by it. I never read the Aquaman comics. He swerved into Aquaman now and then if you read anything with the Justice League. But I always thought Aquaman was kind of lame, and a lot of people did. But when they redesigned him, when I think it was John Byrne redesigned him sometime in the 90s, I think, he really gave Aquaman some oomph to it. And I thought that, you know, Jason Momoa was great in the Aquaman role, not just in Aquaman, but when he showed up in other movies. And I was kind of interested to see this one. I was out of town when it came out, so I never saw it in theaters, so I had a chance to check it out here on the 4K. When it comes to the 4K, it's a beautiful-looking movie, and the 4K treatment that Warner Brothers does is very good. I mean, it looks good. It looks crisp, and it's clean, and they take care in their presentation. So from an image perspective, strictly an image perspective, it's very well done. With that said, there's a lot of CGI in this movie, and that makes sense. I mean, it takes place underwater, and the first movie had a ton of CGI, too. But at a certain point, your CGI either has to be so meticulous and well done, like in an Avatar movie, that your brain accepts it as a real environment, or you're essentially making a cartoon. And this movie kind of swerves into the cartoon territory. I mean, it's when they're underwater, none of it. And I know it's an Aquaman movie, so it's nothing's real in this. But it doesn't even look close to real. You don't even feel like you're in water. You feel like you're watching a cartoon. When I saw Avatar: The Way of Water, as many problems as that movie had, my brain never questioned the underwater environment. It felt real to me. Now, I understand Aquaman was the last in this DC run, and I think they've changed a lot of stuff. I mean, it feels like they changed a lot of stuff. I know they pulled a bunch of Amber Heard stuff because she's kind of persona non grata now, and so her character was reduced a lot. I made some comment on Twitter about this, and one of the Jason Momoa stans came after me because I said, I love the fact that he doesn't have the cut look that he did in the first movie. I love the fact that Jason Momoa is a big enough star that he can be like, yeah, I'm going to dad bod this. I mean, he doesn't look like me, but he also doesn't look like he did before. And this stan came back at me and she's like, he had surgery and he couldn't work out and that's why. And I'm just like, I don't care why. I just love the fact they made an Aquaman movie where he's got a bit of a pot belly. He's still a big dude and could beat the tar out of me. But that's my point, is I kind of like that. But they are putting a CGI suit on him, and like, it's a very crowded story with a lot of characters, and the bad guy's terrible. It's sort of like Black Manta's back, but he's possessed by this king who's world has been frozen or something like that. I don't know. There's so many Kingdom movies. You got this one, you got Frozen Empire coming out with Ghostbusters, you've got the Forbidden Kingdom or something like that with Kong and Godzilla. I don't know. It's getting, the kingdoms and empires are getting a little mixed up right now. But I didn't love this movie, I have to say. I wanted to. I was very excited to see it, but it just, look, it appears to suffer from multiple forms of meddling and overdone CGI. You know, it fails to capture the charm of its predecessor, but like the meddling is like, it's like, it's like, okay, well, we got to take this out. We're going to change this, and we're going to rewrite this, and can you fix this in post? And it really feels like a lot of work was done on this throughout the production, that they never had a true vision and direction of where they wanted everything to go, because they had no idea what it would do. The special features, there's like just like 7 behind the scenes like featurettes, and that's cool. That's certainly better than nothing. But they were just sort of featurettes that were thrown in there. You can tell that everyone was realizing, well, this, when this is over, we got to reboot DC. I wanted to like this one, but I just was kind of bored with it. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, Patrick Wilson and Jason Momoa did their darndest to make it work, but I got to say, it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.